On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
He moved from one end of the shopping plaza to another, but he ended up closing for 4 months. And in the meanwhile, though, he constructed a restaurant on basically on his own. Tables, a bar. He ended up buying old church pews for people to be able to sit in there. Got a muralist in there. Iconoclastic, delicious restaurant. And if you really get in there, really become a fan, ask him for tepache. That's all I'll say.
That's Gustavo Arellano, editor of the OC Weekly and host of KCRW's Orange County Line. He's helping us start off today's show with a must-visit breakfast spot in his neck of the woods. Gustavo, where are we headed today?
We're going to go to Break of Dawn, this amazing diner in one of the most boring cities in Orange County, Laguna Hills.
Yeah, I mean, when I come down to visit you in Santa Ana, this is like one of our great trips.
Oh, my God. Like, it's hard enough to get you down to Orange County to begin with. But I always tell people, you know, when I really like a restaurant, when I become a regular there. And I would figure the same thing with you. And so the fact that when you're down here, we always go down to Break of Dawn. It's really a testament to what a really just amazing, eclectic restaurant it is.
Whose restaurant is it?
Even beyond the food, has an amazing story. The owner is a guy named D. Nguyen. D. Nguyen, you know, Vietnamese refugee, came to this country, studied, I think it was dentistry or some boring profession at UC Riverside, then decided to get into the food world, worked at all the hotels, opened up his place, then had a child who, you know, had some complications with his birth. So what happened was that this place is only open for breakfast and brunch by design, because the rest of the day, Dee wants to be with his son.
It's such an interesting story. So describe some of your favorite dishes on the menu.
What's amazing about Dee's approach is that it's Catholic with a small C, and where he gets approaches from all over the world. My go-to dish is always something that's very simple. It's just sausage and rice, but the sausage is linguiça, so Portuguese sausage. He makes a papaya slaw, you know, green onion puree. He puts a little bit of spice in it. So it's part Hawaiian, part Vietnamese, part Mexican, and all bueno.
So good. He makes his own sausages, right?
Oh, and that's the other thing about Break of Dawn. Dee is very much a stickler. He'll go to Santa Barbara, get a whole bunch of uni, and just start concocting all these dishes with it. He'll make his own sausage, you know, get humongous chunks of beef, make his own pâtés. He really does believe in what he does. Again, going back, since he's so limited in how much he could do, he's going to say, well, if this is the only time I have, I'm going to just push everything into it.
This is the kind of place where you really do want to go with at least four people, because it's very hard to choose when you look at that menu. So give us some other hits of the menu.
Oh, man. Let's see. I'm going back to goat, because I'm a big advocate of goat. So he has a goat chili, the classic Tex-Mex dish, now with goat, and also some chile morita. He has some queso fresco in there. Mix it up. Very earthy, very delicious. Bison sausage. He gets the bison. He makes a sausage himself, mixes it up with black rice. It's really stunning, beautiful dish. Puts in a little bit of fish sauce in there to get the Vietnamese flavor in there. He also makes just a classic banh mi, his own sausage as well. And the other interesting thing about Dee is that even though he has just breakfast and brunch almost daily, he also has pop-up dinner. So once a month, he'll have these, insane 13-course meals where you might have a bite, but by the end, you thought you just ate the whole buffet at, you know, somewhere in the South. And then for those, you're going to have to follow him on social media, because he'll announce it, and then within an hour, they're sold out.
He also has a really interesting take on all of the sort of griddle cakes, French toast, all that kind of stuff. What he does is pretty different and really luxurious.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's not forget his version of lox. You know, he's going to have some smoked salmon that he smokes himself. He has an oatmeal pancake there, a poached egg that I'm not a fan of poached eggs. My wife, Delilah, is a fiend for them, and so he poaches them perfectly from what I hear. And then preserved kumquats. And that's the other thing with D. He lives in South County. He has an amazing garden. As much of the, especially on the fruits, and especially the specialty stuff, he's getting from his garden. So he's getting the nasturtiums. He's getting the kumquats. He's getting the finger limes or the little lime caviar stuff. He's getting some blood oranges. Just, I know in L.A. this seems like nothing extraordinary, but come on. You try to do this in soulless, boring Laguna Hills. And the greatest thing about this is that he has his crowd. Like, if you go there, try to go during the weekday, because on weekends, it's absolutely impossible. You're going to have to wait for a good half hour.
He also makes really incredible hot sauce.
Oh, God, the hot sauce is, you know, it's interesting with D, because even though he is Vietnamese and he got all this influence from him, you know, from just learning in hotels, he has a Mexican soul. So that hot sauce that he makes it, you know, it has just a little bit of ting. It's not sriracha, it's more on the tapatio level, but it has like that umami flavor of a fish sauce, of a Vietnamese fish sauce.
Now, the one dish that I know we always get for the table, because the table has to eat really well to end our giant feast, is it a creme brulee French toast?
It's a French toast creme brulee, abuelita chocolate, some soy caramel, coconut, like the coconut shavings, all on a raisin brioche.
Wow. Thank you so much, Gustavo. Tell us once again where we've been.
The name of the restaurant is Break of Dawn. It's at 24292 Avenida de la Carlota, Suite P4 in Laguna Hills. And the phone number is 949-587-9418.
That was Gustavo Arellano talking about Break of Dawn in Laguna Hills. If it were closer to me, I would go every week. Chefs are always looking for a new challenge. But where do you go when you've been named best restaurant in the world 4 times? When you base your culinary thinking on your natural surroundings, it's natural to change localities. That's what Rene Redzepi, forager extraordinaire, did in December. Redzepi moved Noma from Copenhagen to Sydney for a 10-week run. Tian Lan Ho went along for the ride and wrote about how the team developed an Australian menu. Her article is in California Sunday Magazine. Hi, Tian Lan.
Hi.
What an undertaking. So explain why Rene does a very unusual thing. He did this when he moved the restaurant to Tokyo, too. He takes his entire staff.
That's right. He takes everyone from, you know, his core team, all 45 cooks and stages, all the interns. He sometimes picks up local interns. And he even brings the dishwashers. And he sets up opportunities, too, for people to bring their families. It's really, really is just this adventure as a team building adventure with everyone moving up to a new place in the world and learning all together.
It must be just filled with so much intellectual ferment.
I think so. And I think that's why he does it. I mean, he's always looking for inspiration. He's a perpetually curious chef. And I think that's why he's always doing such new things. And he wants his team to be that way, too. And they all work together so well when they're challenged with something new that they've never worked with before. I think that's those moments when they tasted something new together that they'd never tasted, that you could really see the excitement on everyone's faces. That's what they live for, you know, this discovery of new flavors and textures and aromas.
I know that Rene made 6 trips to Australia to scout ingredients for the menu before opening. And I also know that he tends to give his team these sort of intellectual prompts, things to think about that aren't necessarily tied directly to ingredients. What were some of the things he asked them to think about when going to Australia?
This time he was thinking about these moments that they had had on trips. So one example was being out in the wilderness in Arnhem Land. That's probably some of the most wilderness areas left on the coast anyway. It's in the northeastern part of Australia. They had actually tried to go find freshwater shrimp. They couldn't find them, so instead they were digging around with some local kids who were showing them something they liked to eat. And that whole feeling of just discovering together, this feeling of being able to find whatever you can in the ground, literally buried in mud, pulling it out. It's so different from what we're used to, you know, refrigerated shellfish. You know, it has to be cold and chilled. And this was something very hot. They pulled out this mud clam. I think that sort of feeling is what he's always trying to conjure. So he would talk about that a lot. He would say, remember that perfect mouthful of hot mud clam? And everyone would nod and say yes. And he'd say, how do we get that back?
Now, of course, the chefs at Noman don't just find ingredients. Once they find them, many are subjected to all different kinds of transformation. And this all takes time, and they didn't have a ton of time. So what were some of the fermentation projects that they worked on?
It's funny, you know, a lot of their fermentation projects stem from thinking about what to do with waste. So one of them was mango skins, because the mangoes in Australia are really, really special, and Rene Redzepi actually really personally loves mangoes. He eats them every day for lunch and just loves them as a snack. So they knew he was going to want, you know, a lot of mangoes, but what do you do with the skins? And so that became a mango skin fermentation project. It's sort of like a sour vinegar, not too, still sweet, not as sour as you think it could be, just a really nice, deep, mango-y mango flavor. They play a lot with beef back home, actually beef and grasshoppers. Those are their common garum ingredients. Garum is, you know, usually a fermented fish sauce that's common in the Mediterranean, but also common in Asia, on any coastal area. And so instead of using, you know, things that they would get normally in Copenhagen, they used kangaroo. So it became a kangaroo garum.
So fascinating. So what percentage of failure is there for the research team?
Yeah, there's a lot of failure. These are living things. You know, fermentations, for example, are living things, and anything can go wrong at any time. So you lose, you know, a quarter of what you make there. Then you have, you know, the tastings and the platings when you're trying to figure out what goes together and what really works. And then you just keep whittling and whittling as a team. And so by the end, you know, you come up with 14 dishes for a menu. And everything else you remember and put aside maybe for another time or for family meal.
Were there any dishes that were spectacular but just too expensive to produce for the customers?
Oh, so many. Maybe this is an expensive ingredient, pandanus heart. It's the center of sort of a palmy plant that has little prickly leaves. They're very long. To harvest it, you have to kind of pry the leaves off of this tree, and then you peel everything off, and then you get to the center of this heart. And it's like hearts of palm, but even sweeter. As soon as you peel it, as soon as you take it off the tree, it begins oxidizing. It turns brown, like, within minutes. So there was no way you could harvest that. You know, you couldn't harvest enough of it.
So much of what I think of in Australia are animals and ingredients that are just tough. I mean, they're filled with alkaloids. They're very strange. A lot of them haven't ever been used for food before. Was the team at all worried about poisoning themselves, or did they have to do extensive research?
They always do a lot of research. And in fact, Rene has a couple biologists back home in Copenhagen to help him out there with those ingredients. And out here, he was relying on the expertise of a few foragers and some of the other chefs he knows very well. A couple of people out in the West who all they do is work with native ingredients. So they are always careful, but there can be accidents. And this time, actually, what's amazing about a lot of these ingredients is that the Aboriginal people have definitely eaten almost everything out there. The team, you know, they started slow with things that were recommended to them. And then they have a tendency when they're out in the field to just taste whatever they can. But they have gotten a little bit more careful, and they'll actually ask and say, what do you think about this one? Do you think I can eat it? I think right now they're serving a lantana flower, which is actually common out here in California. You can see them in a lot of gardens. And you can eat the flowers, which are very sweet and fragrant. But if you eat anything else of the plant, it is actually very poisonous. So they're instructing all of their guests just to eat the flowers, which is kind of fun. It's a little bit dangerous.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, what a wonderful article you wrote. It was fascinating.
Thanks so much, Evan. Thanks for having me.
That was journalist Tianlan Ho. Noma Australia is serving lunch and dinner in Sydney through April 2nd. I doubt that you can get in. The waiting list has over 30,000 people. But you can find a link to the article Ho wrote for California Sunday Magazine on our website. You can also find an interview I did with Rene Redzepi there in 2013. Next, we learn all kinds of things you might not know about asparagus. Stay close.
Santa Monica Bay's public radio station, KCRW, relies on the support of its listeners. One way to help is by donating your old car, truck, boat, or motorcycle. We'll pick up the vehicle from anywhere in the country. Put your old ride to good use and take advantage of a great tax write-off. Visit kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. In the last 50 years, robots have taken farming by storm, but asparagus farmers are keeping it old school. Workers harvest plants by hand. Asparagus yields are even affected by the waxing and waning of the moon. Let's go to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to learn more.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It is that time of year when the Zuckerman Delta asparagus comes back to the farmers markets in Southern California. And today at the market, we've got Roscoe Zuckerman IV. He is obviously related to the Zuckerman family. So Roscoe, tell us, we were all on pins and needles. Tell us how the asparagus harvest is going this year and how you grow it and what makes your asparagus so delicious.
Well, it's just like my dad always said, the San Joaquin Delta is to asparagus as Napa is to wine. You know, the rich Delta peat soil that we have up just west of Stockton is just the perfect growing conditions for asparagus. It makes a rich flavor and a good water content. It's crisp, it's flavorful, it's crunchy, it's tender, it's what you want.
And it's so seasonal.
It is seasonal. It's a very short season. We usually start cutting around the 21st of February. We got a little bit of a late start this year, March 1st, and it goes for about 10, 12 weeks.
And does your family do things to keep the soil the same level of fertility and flavor?
Not really. I mean, once an asparagus crop has about a lifetime of 7 to 10 years, and then once you rotate it out, you won't put asparagus back in that ground for another 40 or 50.
So when you take the asparagus out after 10 years, you plant nothing there for 50 years?
No, I mean, typically you could go a fallow period for a while, but you would definitely rotate something in, you know, either potatoes or do a cover crops or put alfalfa in there and till it back in. There's all kinds of different options.
You grow the purple asparagus, you bring in jumbo, you've got the pencil, you've got all different sizes. Can you tell us what the different flavors are of those different asparagus?
In my experience, I find the best flavor to be in the big, thick jumbo green spears. The thin stuff is real tender. I like it for salad and raw applications, maybe a little bit of stir fry. But when I'm grilling, I'm putting those big jumbo spears on the table. And then now the purple is a different animal altogether. It's sweet. It's kind of like a sugar snap pea. And so that's a different variety. That's called Viola. And that's kind of one of our specialty items.
And I actually saw the farm once, and I know that if you cut at one end of the field in the morning and go all the way across, by the end of the day, that first end is already sprouting again.
That is the truth, yeah. And there's all kinds of conditions that people don't know. If there's a lot of water in the soil, if there's a full moon out, yeah, it'll definitely increase the growth rate.
That is amazing. How many times can you cut one field?
During the course of the season, you'll cut it many dozens of times.
Roscoe, can you tell us a little bit about what it's like up there in way Northern California, about the labor situation? How are things going for you farmers?
It's tough. It's tough. We're always needing more labor. I mean, asparagus is a hand-cut crop, and sometimes it's hard to find the right people for the job that got the wherewithal to do it and are willing to put the hours and the time and the attention to detail that we need.
Do you get the same workers coming every year so they really kind of know the routine?
Largely, yes. We asparagus cutters, you want them to be experienced as best as possible, but you take what you get.
Has this recent rain we've had been helping the asparagus crop?
It's kind of a coin toss. You see, it helps the plant. The plant is really, really thirsty. It's going to constantly need more water to be able to grow productively, which is a good thing. But on the other side of that coin is if it's muddy out in the fields, it makes it hard to go in and harvest. So we kind of just, you know, we thank it and we curse it all at the same time.
Thanks so much, Roscoe.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Roscoe Zuckerman IV. I love saying that. He is with the Zuckerman Asparagus Farm, and he's telling us all about what it's like to grow asparagus in the Sacramento Delta. I'm so happy to be talking to a couple of relatively new chefs here at the Farmers Market, Nick Montgomery and Akira Akuto, who were co-chefs at Oso, which is a new restaurant in the Arts District, downtown LA. So tell me what you're buying and what you're going to be making at the restaurant.
So we are picking up some asparagus. We're working on this dish with some grilled asparagus. First, we take it and clean it up a little bit. Sometimes there's a little tough bit on the end where we snap off. It usually has a pretty natural separation point where it just snaps. And then we just toss it in a little bit of oil, salt, pepper, and throw it on the grill just until it's charred. And we'll just cool it down to room temp, more or less, and just layer it with fresh ricotta. Then we have these pistachios. So we just toast a little bit in the oven and sprinkle those on top. A little drizzle of the pistachio oil. And we're also going to take a little bit of sherry vinegar and reduce that with some coconut sugar to make kind of a tart, slightly sweet syrup to drizzle over the top to add some acid and kind of bring everything together.
Is there a particular kind of asparagus, the fat, the thin, the purple?
Well, I've never seen the purple, so I've never worked with it, but that sounds great. We usually did to get the thinner stuff. It's tender, easier to work with, and we're going to grill it just to get a little bitterness to it for the dish. Most of the other components are kind of sweet. So with the ricotta, we have a lot of leftover whey. So we've been playing around with caramelizing the whey, just reducing it down to kind of set it into this brown cheese. It's a kind of a Norwegian cheese called Geitost. It's not hard to make. It's just kind of time-consuming. And then we were thinking about shaving that over the asparagus salad, but we're not sure if it's going to work out, so we'll see. But it's pretty sweet, so we wanted the asparagus to be bitter. So we'll just char it and grill it and see which one works better.
Okay, well, great. So nice to talk to both of you. Nick Montgomery, Akira Akuto. Exciting to hear about the restaurant and embracing the seasonal change with the asparagus.
We've got a recipe for Oso's grilled asparagus with spring onion, pistachio, and ricotta on the Good Food blog. In a minute, we hear from the first female chef in America to receive 2 Michelin stars. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. In 2013, Dominique Crenn became the first female chef in America to receive 2 Michelin stars. It was for her San Francisco restaurant, Atelier Crenn. She has a new cookbook called Metamorphosis of Taste and joins us to talk about what inspired the recipes in the book. Hi, Dominique.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's begin with your dad. Tell us a bit about him.
My dad. My dad passed away in 1999 and is very missed. He taught me art, music. Also, he taught me about kindness and understanding others.
It's so interesting because often the restaurant business is portrayed as a brutal business and a business in which you don't find a lot of kindness.
Sure. I mean, obviously, I wanted to take a different approach of it. As you said, it's pretty brutal inside. The majority of people that work in the industry often, I think it's changing now, but they've been treated very poorly. For me, you know, the best of our industry is the people that are working with us, the cook, you know, the dishwasher and the server, or they are my number one, and you need to treat them with a lot of respect and a lot of cares. I don't believe in violence. I believe in communication and dialogue and also understanding each other. And we all unique in our own way. So it's also having an approach of everybody is not a number, but everyone is someone that is special and someone that is very vital for the company. So it was very important for me to have this approach in my company, in my restaurant.
So let's get a bit into your intellectual culinary mind. Your relationship between poetry and food, can you describe it and how it's reflected in your menu?
Since I was a little girl, I think I started to write poetry when I was 4 years old. When I started to go to a restaurant, I never liked to read menus. And I think the first time I went to Michel Bar in France, this is when it's pocket in my head. That's like, wow, I mean, food is poetry. And it is poetry, you know. I think food is the core of the society, and you need to look at food also as, I think it's a dialogue, it's a communication. So the best way for me to express myself was through poetry, because I think poetry is beautiful and life is beautiful. And I think when you eat something and you come and celebrate something at my restaurant, you need to have that sense of beauty also, not just through the food, but through the words.
Yeah, both you and your pastry chef, Juan Contreras, are inspired a lot by nature.
Yes.
So this appreciation for the larger natural world, how has it been incorporated into his desserts?
Well, I mean, there is a lot of things. You know, we're very thoughtful. We had a dessert called the honey dessert. We met a beekeeper back in Sonoma in 2010, 2011. And there was a lot of discussion about bees and the way that we treat, you know, bees in our world. And we wanted to create a dessert that really speak also for what we believe that is right to do. So we're very connected to nature. It's also perhaps political in a way that we want people to be conscious about, yes, we're putting food on the plate, but there is a meaning to that. And we need to be conscious about what our surrounding and what nature brought to us and really taking care of it.
So we were just talking about how you approach the end of the meal. Let's start with the very beginning. One of your signature dishes is a kir breton.
Yes.
And it shows up as an amuse.
Yes.
Describe how it draws from your childhood in Brittany and how it kind of epitomizes the core philosophy of the restaurant.
This is an inspiration from what my mom used to serve. We used to, my dad was a politician, and we used to have a lot of a dinner at the house. And my mom used to, as an aperitif, that's when she welcomed people to the house. She used to make a kir breton, which is a crème de cassis and a Brittany cider or art cider. It could be, I mean, perhaps sometime it was Normandy cider, but I will say Brittany cider. And so that was really, you know, as a young child, when I was a child, I was very taken by the way she was making the drink. And, you know, I don't drink alcohol and I can't drink a carbonated drink either, but I love the symphony of it when I was looking at her. And she told me about it. And you know, obviously we have a kir royal, which is very French, but the kir breton is more take on the kir royal with cider. So I wanted to celebrate her and the way that she was welcoming people at the house. And that's the way that I want to welcome people at Heliquin, because it's also my house and it's a continuation of what I've been taught as a little girl.
Can you describe it?
It's a cider that we reduce and then we freeze it in a type of a mold. And the mold is like a round mold. And then when it's frozen, we make a syrup from cocoa butter. We take the frozen bowl, we dip it in the syrup, and the cocoa butter, we seal it. Then we put it in the fridge and we temper it. So inside it become liquid, but the cocoa butter is the seal, so the liquid can't get out. And then we get some crème de cassis and we make some type of like puree with it. And we put it on top and then we present it to the guest. And what we ask them to do is to one bite, put it in your mouth, and then there's an explosion that happened.
You write that you believe that we carry experiences inside us until we know what to do with them.
Yes.
I love that. What dining experience unconsciously shaped your future?
Well, I think the first one when I was 9 years old, I think I had my first tasting menu, and I don't think I knew exactly what was going on, but I remember that I watched people around me and I felt like I was in a theater or maybe watching a symphony or the dance, and I was just taken by it. And then I believe that probably perhaps Michel Brau also, without knowing, I think the beauty of the surrounding kind of make me, probably unconsciously shaped me in the way that I am today. I will also mention Olivier Rollinger in Brittany, that, you know, dining with him and talking to him was probably something that was very deep inside of me. But I will say that what shaped me for who I am today was probably not the restaurant, was probably the things that I experienced as a young child with my mom and my dad, and the travel and art and conversation and dialogue about the world. That's probably why I am who I am today.
I would love to know what a dish that really strikes you in particular, maybe a favorite dish that manages to intersect modernist technique with culinary tradition.
My mom used to do a kind of a fish soup in Brittany called the Coriade. And she also did a lot of soup with, could be lobster or crab or shrimp, or it was, you know, she used whatever, you know, seafood we had in the house. I kind of took the flavor of Brittany, what I knew of Brittany, and I make a lobster dish with seaweed and kind of a bone marrow dumpling and a lot of yummy stuff inside, with also a little bit of cream. And so the core of the dish is very rooted in the way of making a fish stock, but there is a lot of technique. First of all, like to do other things with it. So when you eat, you know, the lobster dishes, it's might look very modern to you, but when you taste it, it's like I think you will know the taste, and it will take you back to perhaps something that you also experience in your life. And that's what my dish are about.
You use dehydrators.
Yes.
A lot in several of your dishes. Tell me what ingredients you're drying and how you're incorporating them into recipes. I have to say that your carrot jerky is particularly intriguing.
It's a long time to make it.
I bet.
Well, I mean, when you think about dehydrating things, you know, I mean, it's very ancient, not the machine, it's the equipment in itself. But, you know, for many, many centuries, people were drying things out. It intensified the flavor. And I'm very interested in that. So luckily, you know, a technique allow us to dehydrate anything we want. The carrot jerky, for example, there is a process. We take the water out, we cook it and dehydrate it again. And so when you dehydrate the carrot, it bring back the flavor of the carrot in a way that you could not have it if you didn't, you know. That's what I love, dehydrating things. It's because it intensified the flavor, and that's what I'm looking for.
That was Dominique Crenne. Her restaurant and the name of her book is Atelier Crenne. You can try Dominique's recipe for Cuir Breton, made with cocoa butter shells filled with cider and creme de cassis. That's on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, we turn to another chef with some serious kitchen credentials, Tim Hollingsworth. He's opened up a new restaurant downtown, and Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, is here to tell us about it. Hi, Jonathan.
Hello, Evan.
Where are you taking us today?
We're going downtown to Bunker Hill, to Otium, which I think is possibly the most spectacular new restaurant to have opened in Los Angeles in years.
Who is helming the restaurant?
The restaurant is, I guess, helmed by the Sprout Group, who owns so many restaurants in and around Los Angeles, including Bastia and Redbird. The chef is Timothy Hollingsworth, who spent several years as the chef de cuisine at French Laundry in Napa Valley. Nobody has a better pedigree than this guy.
What does odium mean?
Apparently, it has something to do with leisure. It's a Latin word. Maybe somebody was reading Horace in their spare time. I don't know.
Okay. First of all, I guess you should describe the restaurant itself.
It's right next door to the Broad. You can see the Broad from all the windows in the place. Like a pavilion in a park, it's glass-walled. And the kitchen is not just open, but you're not really sure where the kitchen ends and the dining room begins. The thing about Odium that is ambitious, despite the fact that it's built from scratch and has a famous chef and all that, is they're trying to invent what an American restaurant might be at the moment, which is difficult, right? I mean, we're not just doing the French things that everybody might have done 25 years ago. We're not doing the sort of upscale casual dining that Wolfgang Puck did. It's not a modern izakaya. It's something else. And I think he's trying to nudge American cooking into the conversation. And by American, I don't just mean, you know, mac and cheese and fried chicken and, you know, all those fancy Sunday dishes that James Beard did, but the sort of American cooking as most of us would experience it in 2016. You know, we grow up, we go to sushi bars, we go to falafel stands, we get shawarma, we go to a steakhouse. If you go to brunch there, you can get things that are versions of like pozole and Egyptian fool and, you know, a French duck leg dish and Korean bibimbap and British Finn and Haddie, San Francisco Hangtown Fry. It's like all of that coming together. And some of the things that Hollingsworth is adopting as basically his signatures are things that we would never have contemplating being in a restaurant like that. For example, there's the funnel cake, which I'm not sure I've ever had outside the context of a fair.
Right.
And it comes out in, you know, sort of this big oval, and they put, you know, baby greens on it, sometimes different kinds of sorrel. There's different kinds of cream on it, and there are little puffs of what you would not know unless somebody told you were foie gras mousse.
So he's taken the lowest of the mass eating experience from a county fair, and he has elevated it.
Right. It's sort of beautiful. And you keep going through his menus. Like, there's beef tartare, you know, hand-chopped, and there's, like, drained yogurt, there's mint, there's a little bit of bulgur. It's, you know, kibinaya, right? Except an American version. There's sliced lamb, roasted, nicely charred. I'm sure it's sous vide somewhere. But it's served with yogurt and a spicy sauce and the sea of what looks like white beans but are actually like pine nuts that have been softened in the demi-glace that's the sauce.
Wow.
So you're getting the effect of the shawarma, but you're getting a completely different effect that has never existed alongside shawarma.
Are these individual large plates?
All of the plates are designed to be big enough to be shared.
Was there anything you really wished was yours?
There was this beautiful black cod dish. I think a lot of people are realizing that black cod is the one fish that's sort of native to California that's really, really good. And it's crisp skin. It's still a little wobbly rare. It separates into flakes the way that you want that kind of fish to. It's served with clams dusted with like a powder they make from charred onions over what reliable people have told me was a sauce made with Maggie seasoning.
I don't know how to respond to that.
I know that the Maggie was the thing that brings you off, right? So it's like it's the highest of the high and it's the lowest of the lows.
I hear the raw fish on the menu is worth trying.
There's a lot of good raw fish dishes. Like, my favorite was fluke, which is, you know, sort of a slightly crunchy flounder-like fish. The fillets were cured with zest from boudihan, which is that very weird citrus fruit you see in the farmer's market and you have no idea what to do with, that was laid onto these super light, crisp, lacy crackers that he made from black rice. Fluke is a blandish fish, so he made it like a little bit fishier by dotting it with marinated salmon roe. There were some herbs. There's some like crunchy little bits of sea bean and just shaved kumquat. There's a bunch of really interesting vegetable dishes, including like a bowl of roast carrots, probably roasted over fire because there's smokiness to it, splashed with the Mexican sea sauce, pipián, the sort of crunchy, gritty, like Central Mexican thing. And there's a smear of tart cream on the bowl just under the rim. The dish comes together really nicely.
Sounds like a place to go.
Let's go sometime.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Odium in downtown Los Angeles. Text the words good food to 69866, and you'll get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. Up next, we stay with Jonathan Gold to taste barbecue in Texas. Stay close.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe, Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
South by Southwest kicks off in Austin this weekend. So in honor of the annual Music and Film Fest, we revisit last year's barbecue crawl through Central Texas.
Barbecue is one of those binge foods. People often, you know, tell you, yeah, I'm going to go to three or four pits, and like nobody goes out and has three or four different cheeseburgers in a day, or goes to Italy and goes and has four plates of spaghetti carbonara in an afternoon. That actually sounds like a good afternoon, come to think of it.
That, of course, is Jonathan Gold, who planned our barbecue crawl. Our first stop is Lexington, about an hour outside of Austin. It was there that we met one of the most famous pitmasters in Texas, Tootsie Tominetz.
When I started barbecuing, I had no idea it would get to something like this. My husband was working in a meat market in Giddings. There was only one person working the pit that day. The other two gentlemen had called in sick. So the boss asked my husband, said, do you think Tootsie would come in and help Orange out at the pit? So he called, and I said, well, yes. I said, I don't know that much about meats. And he said, well, anybody that can help will be better than nothing. Well, I guess I made them a good hand because they kept me on for 10 years.
Today, Tootsie has 50 years of barbecue experience under her belt. Now she tends the pits at Snow's in Lexington alongside Carrie Bexley. Back in 2008, Texas Monthly voted Snow's the number one barbecue joint in Texas, and it changed their business forever.
It blew our minds. I mean, all Carrie and I could do was sit in each other's arms and cry.
The first few years you were in this location, the crowds must have been much less, right?
Oh, it was very much less. In fact, I would get here at 2 o'clock a.m. Saturday mornings because I didn't have to have the briskets ready until around 10 when our local people came in to get something for Saturday lunch or Sunday lunch.
But people are here from all over the world.
Yes, from everywhere.
Have taste in barbecue changed, you think?
Maybe a little bit. I don't know how or why. I mean, we only season with salt and pepper. When we were named number one, we did not have the big pits that we have here now. So we had to borrow pits, and they all cooked differently until he finally got the big water tank that he made our big brisket pit out of.
So you're cooking it longer now?
No, it's about the same. 2 to 10 or from
10 to 8.
Are you up all that time, or do you put them on and then someone else is sitting babying them while you go back to sleep?
Well, I fudge there. I stay at home until usually 2 o'clock a.m. I usually get here at 2 o'clock.
Did you get any guff from people for being a woman working the pits?
No, really not. They will just say, why do you think there are not more women that do it? I don't know. It's just something that I enjoy doing.
You seem made for it.
Well, thank you. And actually, I was raised on the farm, so I knew what work was. I was the oldest of 3 children. I was always with Daddy in the field, learning to plow and baling and raking hay and hauling cotton to the gin. We had a cotton gin here in Lexington at that time, years ago.
That was the one, the only Tootsie Tominets. She and her business partner, Carrie Bexley, run the pit at Snow's Barbecue in Lexington. Why did we end up driving an hour outside of Austin to Lexington in the first place? Yes, it does have to do with the fact that Snow's was voted number one by Texas Monthly back in 2008. But more importantly, it has to do with my compañero for this trip, Jonathan Gold. You know him as the critic for the LA Times, the belly of Los Angeles, and the only food writer to ever win a Pulitzer. But what you probably don't know is that he is a man who is deeply passionate about barbecue.
There used to be this almost religious fervor over the Texas Monthly Top 50 barbecue issue. I used to actually subscribe to Texas Monthly just to get that issue, which you couldn't really buy on newsstands in LA. And you'd sit there and you'd paw over the list and you'd see that, like, you know, Zimmer Hansel's or something went up a half star in the ratings. And you'd sort of dream of the day when you would be able to go and follow it.
How long ago were you here last?
It's been a while. I was here, I think, in 1999. I was doing one of my favorite stories that I've ever done. I was about to, you know, leave the LA Weekly to go to New York to work for Gourmet, and I'd been doing a lot of work for Travel and Leisure, so the editor, as sort of a benevolent gesture, offered me the chance to do any piece that I wanted. I could go anywhere in the world. And I think she probably thought I was going to go to, you know, Lyon and write about the haute cuisine, or go to Tokyo and write about kaiseki meals. But I asked her to rent me a Cadillac, fly my family to Austin, and we'd drive around for 2 weeks and eat barbecue. Central Texas, A, has always been, you know, cattle country. And there was a big German influx around the beginning of the last century. And a lot of them, you know, were meat guys, were butchers. And German food has always had a big tradition of smoking. And it sort of came to its perfect fruition with sort of the abundance of beef and a abundance of people who knew what to do with it. And barbecue has also been like a people's meat, right? I mean, you sell the primals, you sell your steaks, you sell the expensive parts of the cow, and then the parts of the cow that aren't so expensive, you would smoke because A, they would keep for a while, and B, you know, you get such a succulence from cooking low and slow and breaking down the connective tissue that would ordinarily make it tough and just making it just totally beautiful and luscious.
I'm ready for it.
And Lockhart, more than any other city, can probably be called the capital of Texas barbecue, which is, as Texans would say, means the capital of barbecue. There's Smitty's, which is in the building that's one of the oldest barbecues in the state. It's absolutely spectacular. We'll be there in a few minutes. It was, for most of its existence, called Kreitz, but there was a family feud, and half of them have a place out by the highway called Kreitz, and half of them broke off into Smitty's in the original building. There's also a place called Black's Barbecue in town that would be the best barbecue place in almost any town in Texas, but it has a lot of competition. And there's a fourth place whose name is escaping me at the point, which is the youngster in the game because it's only been there since 1968. It makes it practically an adolescent. And then there's a place that I absolutely love about 10 minutes south of town called the City Market in Luling, who I remember having maybe the best smoked sausage I've ever had in my life.
I seem to be on this trip drawn almost more to the sausage than anything else, which might seem heresy, but it's so good. It's so snappy and juicy.
That natural skin is a wonderful thing. And they all have that, you know, nice, peppery, coarse ground, totally juicy thing going on. Earlier this morning, I went to, like, we hadn't gotten plastic knives, so remember I picked up a piece of that sausage. I was going to snap off a piece, and the juice just catapulted across the table and into your hair. I'm sorry about that.
Take exit 470 onto US 183 South toward Lockhart.
She seems like a chicken wing kind of gal.
She probably does not have a hearty appetite.
We should ask her, where's the best place to eat barbecue, and see what she says.
What's the best place to eat barbecue in Lockhart, Texas?
The best rated restaurant is Black's Barbecue, located 8 miles to your south.
Humph.
I don't know who you are, but you can tell me. In Siri settings, tap on my info and then choose yourself.
Snotty. We're at Smitty's Grocery in Lockhart, Texas, which is sort of the grand cathedral of barbecue with, you know, huge high ceilings and, you know, vents that look like they were hacked out of ancient brick walls, and, you know, men, you know, hunched over the pits that are still huge live fires on the floor feeding into this flue, which is going through the pit, which is going up through this giant ceiling. It's just a magnificent machine. And after standing in line for quite a while, as is the custom, we ordered a bunch of fat and a bunch of lean. Fat is what they call brisket, and lean is what they call shoulder clod, which was the traditional Texas barbecue cut 50, 60 years ago, now supplanted by brisket, but is still really popular in parts of the state. We got some little ring sausages, and we got some ribs just because.
When we finished lunch at Smitty's, it was after 3 o'clock, which meant time to get back in the car and head to our last stop, Luling.
Luling itself is famous for a festival they have every year called the Thump Festival. It's a center of watermelon growing. and they have a Thump Festival, and every year they anoint a Thump Queen and her court.
Jonathan, as we approach our third stop of this barbecue crawl, I'm wondering if there is a strategy that we should be thinking of.
Well, I suppose the general strategy would be taste, don't eat. But so this food actually demands to be eaten. Part of it is like the having of the meat as opposed to the eating of the meat. And the idea that we're in a region we're probably not going to visit or revisit that soon. So there's a temptation to sort of taste everything everywhere in hope for that one perfect bite. We've done okay, though.
We did manage to find some room for ice cream cones.
Yeah, we probably wouldn't have had the ice cream cones been smoked.
When we arrive in Luling, the line is wrapped around the restaurant. There are families sprawled out across tables, butcher paper held down by mounds of meat, and styrofoam cups of neon big red soda. It's hot. The line is long, very long, and I admit I almost threw in the towel. Did we really need more brisket, more ribs, more sausage? But Mr. Gold Stamina never wavered.
Can I have a half pound of brisket, fat end, please? And one sausage and three ribs. And a couple pickles.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
As we settled into our booth, a gentleman exited the kitchen and with masking tape put up a sign on the window. Scrawled out on butcher paper were the dreaded words, sold out.
Barbecue crawls are finite by nature because you could only start at a certain time. The lines are extremely long and the drives are long and places run out of meat. So we were the last people in line practically. And there were probably 50 people in line behind us who were incredibly disappointed when they
crushed. Can you imagine waiting in line for an hour and a half, and that's it, no more?
You have to console yourself with a block of cheese and some jalapeno peppers.
What time is it now?
5.
It's 5, and we started out at 8 o'clock in the morning for our first stop. So we've been at this all day. We've done 3, and at each spot, we've had almost the same cuts.
And there's a thing about coming to a restaurant once, especially a restaurant with as many variables in the cooking processes as barbecue. For example, I go to the same bakery for croissant probably 3 or 4 times a week, and I can almost tell you what the weather is outside by the consistency of the croissant, right? It changes that much. That I almost like run there when there's a Santa Ana because I know it's going to be, you know, crackly and crispy and almost definitely buttery. And on a day where it's sort of drizzly, maybe I don't even go there because I know it's going to be denser and not quite as like flaky as I would like. And it's like that with barbecue. Everybody we've talked to and everything we've tasted, there's so much difference in the wood, and there's so much difference in the way wood burns when it's windy out or when it's still, when it's just rained or when it's, you know, been hot and sunny, when it's been the sort of like 50 degree mornings we've been experiencing. And in the summertime, we're in central Texas, sometimes it's like 100 degrees for 2 solid months in a row without a break.
I have to thank you. Thank you for being so. We had this wonderful excuse to have this fantastic experience. What a treat.
It's been great.
Let's eat this apricot pie. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food On Demand on KCRW's mobile app. Many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Tse, Joseph Stone, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food. But if you're still with me, I have a postscript to this week's show. I'm dipping my toe into yet another profession. My first food studies class at UCLA is called We Are Stardust, A Moral Ecology of Food. If you're an undergrad at UCLA, check out Food Studies for Summer Session A. If you're a curious non-student, there'll be more information coming on the speaker-based class. Take care and have a great week.
Bye bye, Daddy, I don't need you no more. Tell me, little woman, who'd you give my barbecue to? I'm a poor boy.